Welcome to the show. So this is arguably one of my biggest guests I've ever had on the show, the guitarist from Kix, Brian Damage Forsythe. So Kix was a big band in the 80s. Their biggest album was Blow My Fuse, went platinum and included the song Don't Close Your Eyes, which hit number 11 on the top 40 pop charts. So that's a big crossover hit, and that's how I found the band. It was probably one of those TV CD ads for Monster Ballads. Remember that? So they had all those 80s hairband ballads. I found that song and I liked it. Then I dug a little deeper into some of their other stuff, like songs like Cold Blood and the title track from Blow My Fuse. A lot of good songs they had. I also really like their comeback album from 2014. It's called Rock Your Face Off. So I reached out to Brian and he agreed to do the interview. It was a lot of fun. And Brian was very candid in the interview. He talked about the early days of Kix, the 90s where he hit rock bottom, and all the way back to his comeback. A lot of great stories. You know, he had run-ins with Steven Tyler and Aerosmith, Bret Michaels and Poison. He has a great story about a band that he was in with Steven Adler, who of course was the drummer from Guns N' Roses. Oh, and how he was friends with Johnny Depp back when Depp was in a band. Just a lot of random stuff like that. And then he'll talk about his diet, which consists of only eating meat. So that's kind of interesting. A lot of great stuff. I hope you guys enjoy it. I had a blast talking music with Brian Forsythe of Kix. Here we go. Brian, hi. It's Chuck Shute from the Chuck Shute Podcast. How you doing?
Good.
Welcome to my show.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you live outside of Nashville with your cat, and you've been there about a year. How's it going over there? How you doing with the lockdown now?
Well, you know, a lot of people ask me that question, and you know, it's funny because you know, I Kix, well, when Kix was up and running, we were doing mostly just fly dates. So you know, I would just take a Lyft ride to the airport, jump on a flight, go do shows, and when I come back, I'm just here at my house, like in between shows. So yeah. This is actually normal for me. It's just a little extended.
Gotcha. So you're kind of a homebody anyways.
Yeah, I don't mind just hanging out at home. It's hard for me to get out of the house even to go see music sometimes. I mean, I have done it a few times while I've lived here, but I'm not one of those people that goes running around everywhere.
Why is it hard for you to get out of the house to go see music?
Well, because I'm lazy.
Okay, gotcha. Interesting. So I kind of want to go through it. I got a lot of questions. You actually have a lot of fans, I don't know, that are like really into your band still. Like I was on the Facebook group and I just told them, hey, I'm going to be interviewing Brian today from Kix, and do you guys have any questions? Thinking there'd be like three or four. I got like a ton. I got bombarded with questions, so I'm gonna try to get through as many as I can. But no, that's a good thing. It's great. But originally, you wanted to be a garbage man before you got in the music business, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Before, when I was like 6 years old or so.
A little kid, yeah. And then you saw the Beatles, right? That's what kind of made you decide you wanted to be in a band?
Yeah. I was from as early as I can remember. Like, I don't even remember how young I was because it was probably before I even knew how old I was. I was into music. My parents used to listen to music all the time around the house.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved music. But then when I saw it, you know, when I saw the Beatles performing it, that's what really did it for me.
So you were like what, like 8 or 9, you heard Hendrix, that blew you away. So when did you actually start playing music, like guitars and?
Probably around that time, at 8 or 9. I started around 8 years old, and then I got my first guitar for my 9th birthday.
And did you take lessons, or was it self-taught, or both? Or
well, my older brother played. He played, you know, just acoustic. Like he played Bob Dylan songs and stuff.
Ah.
So he taught me the basics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly that. He taught me the chords, and then I would just borrow his songbooks because he had all these songbooks, you know, and they had the little chords above the, you know,
like
above
the tablature.
The music.
Is that what it's called? Right. I used to play guitar with the tablature, right? Or is it different?
Well, tablature is a little more involved. This is just the little chord chart above the music. So it's really easy to follow. And so that's what I did. And I ended up, I pretty much got the basics down as far as chord changes. And then when I was about 14 or so in junior high school, I took a few months of lessons just to, because I couldn't figure out how to tour. So that was the first time. Well, I take that back. I met Steven Tyler once before that, like very briefly. We were in New York City. I think it was during, it might have been Midnight Dynamite era or something. And I think it was just Steve and I were out at this club in the Upper West Side of New York City. And our lawyer that we had at the time was really good friends with Steven Tyler, and he goes, "Hey, I'm gonna get Steven to come down and meet you guys." So you know, at the club, and sure enough, like a half hour later, Steven shows up, but this was like during the downtime when he was like, man, he must have weighed like 90 pounds or something.
Oh my God!
Like, I mean, he was so like skinny, and he was like almost like just floating, like wow. You know, he didn't weigh, but he. He was really nice, and we met him just for a second, but I think we were on the way somewhere else and had to go. We couldn't hang out. But then later on when we opened for them, we didn't really meet him that, like get to hang out with him or anything at the venue, but I remember there was this after party, some friends of mine were having near, this was at the Capitol Center in Largo, Maryland. Where we opened for them. So I go to these friends had a room nearby at this hotel. So I go there and it turns out that the band was staying there too, Aerosmith. And at some point during this party, there's this knock at the door and it was Steven Tyler and Rick Dufay. And they come busting in the room and, you know, they started like doing everybody's drugs
Jeez.
So Steven goes, like, I was the only one there that was in the band, though, which was kind of worked out to my advantage because Steven goes, okay, I'm right down the hall. He goes, only the guys in Kicks can come down to my room, and I'm the only guy in Kicks. So I got to go down there.
Nice.
And it was me, and I was married at the time, so it was me, my wife, and a couple road crew guys. So we all go down there to his room, and he just pulls me over there and sits me on the bed. Like he just sits there on the bed and we just had this weird conversation. But I think he was like, you know, he's kind of a little bit out of it. And
that was the drug times then, obviously.
Yeah. But he was really friendly and nice. Mm. And it was really cool to meet like, you know, somebody that I've listened to since a teenager and he turned out to be like this really cool guy. And then later on, I met him a bunch of times after that, and we opened for them on the Back in the Saddle tour, and when Joe Perry came back, so that was cool.
And when they got sober too, so that was probably a little bit different.
That was right before. That was probably they just got back together, but they hadn't gotten sober yet. It was still a very interesting show.
Yeah, because like you said, he's so skinny. He's already skinny. So, yeah, if he's doing drugs and then it's always, I remember when I was a kid, I met Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses and he was trying to sign my autograph and his hand was shaking. And I was just a kid. I didn't understand. I was like, what's wrong with this guy? You know, looking back, now, you know, it must have been something he was on. But yeah, it's kind of weird when you see those guys all strung out.
Yeah, well, Duff was he was a big drinker. He was probably just had the shakes or something.
Oh, maybe, yeah. So, but back to the 70s, I love this name of this band. You were in a band called Vanilla Grass, which just sounds like a pothead band, but you actually played the drums and the guitar and you'd switch off. So do you still play the drums or is that another one that you had to take lessons or just learn from someone else? Because that seems like a hard thing to do to me. Like when I look at musicians like playing the drum kit, I mean, I've tried it a couple of times. It's really difficult, isn't it? Or does it just come easy for you?
No, it's one of those things where it seems difficult until you figure it out. But It was funny because right around the time I started playing guitar, I was also interested in drums, and I couldn't decide what I wanted to do. And we had a neighbor. It was like a quarter mile up the road, but it was the next house up the road because we lived out in the country. But he had he didn't have a proper drum set either. But he knew how to play drums. But he built this fake drum set out of where are you from? Where are you calling from?
So I'm originally from Seattle, but I'm calling from Phoenix.
Oh, okay. So okay. So this is an East Coast reference.
Okay.
But there's a potato chip company called Utz Potato Chips. And, they're like a Pennsylvania, company, but they used to make these big, cardboard barrels of chips, like these big king size things. So this neighbor friend took these barrels and he made this drum set out of them. And I ended up making my own drum set at my house out of the same thing. And that's kind of how I taught myself how to play. And I actually had a proper snare drum because I took snare drum in elementary school.
Okay.
So I learned how to do all that junk. And then later, like a year or two later after that, when we moved again, and this is after I got my guitar. So I owned my own guitar at that point. And then this friend of my older brother's that lived down the road had a real drum set. He had a set of Ludwig drums. And him and his brother both played, and they're really good. So I used to ride my bike down there, and he would take me up to his room and set me down and show me how to play. And that sort of got me going. And then later on, I ended up getting my own set of drums. And that's when that band that we got together in junior high, you know, I already knew how to play guitar, but I really loved playing drums. So we got that band together and I was the drummer.
Yeah.
And, but there was another, the guitar player could also play a little drums too. So,
right, so you switched off.
Yeah. So we would switch, and then it got to where I was starting to get better on guitar than the guitar player. And then we decided to bring in a drummer and just have two guitars. So that's what happened.
Oh, smart. Okay.
So then I also realized, you know, I mean, I could play drums and it was fun, but I think I was meant to play guitar. Sure. I don't think I could have made it as a drummer. I don't think that was my instrument.
Absolutely. No, you're a very good guitarist. So then you guys started in 77. This was crazy that Kix started in 77, but that's when you started Kix. And it was originally called, first it was called The Shoes, S-H-O-O-Z, but then there was another band with that name. So then you guys called yourself The Generators, but then there was another band with that name. So finally then it was kind of like, it sounded like kind of a last ditch kind of thing. We're like, oh, we'll just call the band Kix, because your other guitarist, Ronnie, was in a band called Jax, J-A-X, and I don't know how he came up with that name, but I'm curious, since you kept getting sued for having the same band name, the cereal company didn't ever try to come after you for having the name Kix?
No, we cleared it. The name, but I think it was because it wasn't a name of a product. I don't know how we got away with it. Well, actually, that band Jax was a band that Donnie was in.
Donnie, sorry, not right.
Yeah, he was in a band, Jax, J-A-X. But he was also in a band called Kix, K-I-C-K-S.
Oh.
And he just took those two names and sort of combined them.
Yeah, because
he liked it. He liked the three-letter kind of thing. But yeah, so with the name, yeah, that was weird.
Well, it's just funny because didn't Green Jelly or Green Jello, the band, they got sued by Betty Crocker for having that name. And so then they had to change her name to Green Jelly. So it's just interesting. I guess maybe that was people were a little less litigious back in those days, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know how we got away with that. But I know, you know, because, well, the original name Shoes, S-H-O-O-Z-E, the other band was called Shoes. Well, we were called The Shoes.
Oh.
Spelled that way, and then the other band was called, I think they were just called Shoes, but they were spelled S H O E S. Mm. And but they had a song on the radio at that time, so that's why we couldn't use that name. And then the Generators, there was another band there, but
sure.
But so when it came to that, to using Kix, the record company did the research just to make sure, because they did it, you know, with the other names, and so that's why we had to change those. So
gotcha.
they did it with this, and I don't understand what the difference was, but we got to use it.
That's awesome. Well, so then you guys had the self-titled album, you had the Cool Kids album. So am I correct? Tell me if I'm wrong, but those first two albums, it's kind of a little bit of almost a different sound, almost like a little maybe poppier, or I don't know. How would you describe the sound on those first couple records?
Yeah, they are. The first record was, it came out in 81. So it was before, it was kind of early. It was coming out of the 70s. There was the punk thing. There was the new wave thing at that time. So there was a lot of other.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like the Knack or some stuff like that. Like that's the sound of the time, right? It wasn't as hardcore metal. Right.
Yeah, the Knack was big then. The Pretenders. In fact, the inspiration for my guitar tone on The Itch was the Pretenders, because I love the sound of the guitars.
Oh, yeah, that's a good comparison too. Okay. So, I mean, it's cool that I was listening to another podcast you were on, and you're talking about, this is interesting how you brought this up, how, a lot of times bands would have one or two albums to make it. And if they didn't make it, the record company dropped them, but your record company stuck with you for those first two albums. I mean, they weren't like terrible, but you guys didn't have like a big hit or anything. You didn't have gold records, but they stuck with you. Was there a lot of struggles for those first couple records? Like somebody mentioned today on the Facebook group, there's a story that Steve tells about a biker coming in and smashing your soundboard back in the early days. Is there truth to that story?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Where was that? Warrington, Virginia. Some hole in the wall. It was called Cross Creek, and it was a biker bar. And it was just in the middle of nowhere on this like two-lane highway. And to get to it, you had to drive off the road on it like a dirt road. And it went across a creek, hence the name Cross Creek. And it was just like this cinder block building, and it didn't even have bathrooms. You had to go to outside to go. There was bathrooms in the back, detached from the building. And, it was mostly bikers and just rednecks. And, it was a rough crowd. And it was the first show, like we had played there before, but I think it was the first show there with Steve and our sound man, because our sound man was actually in a band with Steve before we got Steve. We stole Steve from that band. But so the sound man came with Steve. So he was, so it was both of their first shows with us. At some point during the night, some drunken biker comes in, and I don't know if they had a baseball bat or an axe handle. Like, I didn't see it. Sound man had to deal with it.
Was he just drunk out of his mind, or was he mad about something, or what?
I don't know if there was a couple different stories going around. Somebody said he was doing it on a dare, or there was some kind of initiation that he had to go do something. I don't know. But he comes in there, and luckily our soundboard was it had like this wooden frame built around it.
Oh.
So he just smashed the wooden frame. It didn't actually hurt the soundboard.
Oh, that's good.
Luckily.
Yeah. What other struggles did you have during those days? Because I've heard so many stories of stuff like that where bands get their gear stolen and get stranded in towns and don't get paid. I mean, did you have a lot of that in the first couple records?
Yeah. We didn't have... Well, luckily we didn't have our truck stolen, because I've heard of that nightmare where everything gets stolen. But I had a few guitars stolen along the way, and then not getting paid, that happened a few times. And there was a couple times where it was like really sketchy. Where and this was the early days, before we had a proper booking agent and stuff like that. But there was a place down in, what is it, Fayetteville? That North Carolina, or it's right on
Indiana?
The border, I think. No, it was North Carolina, Fayetteville.
Okay, I'm terrible at geography.
Yeah, and it was some club. It was the only time we ever played there. I can't remember the name of the club. But anyway, we did the show, and the way that we worked it is Donnie booked most of the shows, like around Baltimore and that area. Mm-hmm. And then for some reason, Steve handled all the, like, the North Carolina shows. So this was one of the shows that Steve had booked. And at the end of the night, we're packing up, and Steve goes back to get paid. And the guy didn't want to pay us, or he wasn't going to pay us everything. I forget if it was just nothing or if it was just a partial payment or something happened. And so Steve pulls out the contract and puts it down on the guy's desk, and you know, pointing out that what we're supposed to get. And I wasn't back there, but Steve told me later. He goes, the guy, he opens up his desk drawer and pulls out a 357 Magnum. And he sets it down on the desk, and he goes, "This is what I think about your contract." He goes, "Now get out of here."
Wow.
Before I call the cops. So Steve comes back out there and he tells us about it. And sure enough, a few minutes later, the cops show, or maybe Steve threatened to call the cops or something. But the cops show up, and they were on the club owner's side, and they stood there and kept an eye on us and made sure we loaded everything out and sent us on our way.
And you never got paid?
That was the end of that one.
That's
but
terrible.
The same thing happened up in West Virginia one time. We played some club, and something happened at the end of the night, and the guy didn't want to pay us.
Hmm.
And we tried to demand it, and he got all his bouncers, and they just made us load out. And it was weird because we always had a road crew, and so we went out to the van while the road crew was loading up, and next thing we knew, these big burly guys come out there, and they go, "What are you guys doing? Get in there and help them." Like, they made us go in there and actually load out the stuff. They thought we were just being lazy.
That's crazy. Well, hopefully that stuff doesn't happen anymore, because now we got, like, the internet and people can write a nasty Yelp review about that or something.
Yeah. No, that hasn't happened in a long time.
That's good. So going back.
And nowadays, though, you get a deposit beforehand.
That's good. Yeah.
You know,
Everything's electronic too, right? You don't have like cash as much, right? I would hope.
Yeah.
That's good. So going back to your journey. Go on.
Oh, I was going to say though, I was playing with Rhino Bucket there for a while, and Rhino Bucket was a little bit on the lower scale of things as far as touring.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I ended up being in charge of getting paid. And the one thing that I did learn, though, from all those years of experience is always get paid before you play. Because after you play, you have no leverage.
Right.
Because you've already done it.
Yeah.
So that was one of my philosophies. When we get to a club, and like an hour before it was time to go on, I'd go back and I'd say, okay, you know, we want our money or we're not going on.
Yeah, no, that's smart. Yeah, because otherwise, once you play, you can't do anything. So. But going back to your journey here, so then in 85, you did the Midnight Dynamite album. It was recorded in New York. You know what I really like about that album especially is the album cover, because it's a picture of Steve, your singer, holding a microphone that has a fuse at the end of it. It looks like he's holding a stick of dynamite. Who came up with that idea? Do you remember? I think that was a really clever idea. In fact, I think Vince Neil copied it, and his microphone is like, it has like a fuse on it, and it looks like a stick of dynamite. I think he must have got that idea from you guys.
Probably. A lot of people steal stuff from us. But, I don't know. I can't remember exactly who came up with that idea. I mean, it could have been Donnie, because a lot of times Donnie would come up with stuff like that.
Sure.
Or it could have been the photographer even.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Or maybe your producer, because the album was produced by Bo Hill, and I think this guy's like a genius producer. I didn't realize he was actually accepted to Yale, and he declined that to do a music career. And he's produced for Alice Cooper and Winger and Warrant, Rat Europe. So what was it like working with Bo Hill? I mean, what does that guy add to a record?
Well, he had his routine. It was kind of like he had just done that big Rat record, and so he had a system worked out, like the way that he would record. So it was pretty smooth, like the setup, the way he did it. We would set up two amps, both Ronnie and I. We'd have one that was just full blast, full on, and the other one was a little cleaner sound, and he would blend the sound.
Oh.
So he was really good at getting sounds, and that was a rough record, though. I remember the one thing, he did a really good job on it. In fact, he did a really good job on that Blow My Fuse remix thing. Mm-hmm. I thought that turned out really well.
Yeah.
But I remember back in the Midnight Dynamite days, I really struggled with Bo as far as, he worked with Warren DeMartini and Gary Moore and all these like hotshot guitar players.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sort of bring that up with Ronnie and I, and sort of, I don't know, it was probably my own insecurities, but, it kind of made me feel like inferior and like I didn't really know what I was doing. And, it made it really intimidating when I'd go in there to try to do my solos and stuff. And, and a lot of times he wasn't happy with it, and I would have to insist, like, no, that's good. That's the way I want it to sound.
So he's better for perfectionist, it sounds like.
Well, he was more into the modern, West Coast, finger tapping kind of guitar styles. And Ronnie and I are just basic blues players, really.
Oh.
I mean, that's what I do. I'm not a hot shot.
You're not a Eddie Van Halen, yeah.
No, I mean, I learned from Southern Rock and right. ZZ Top,
Yeah.
But like, one instance in particular was, we were doing Cold Shower, and I'm doing that solo, and I was using my Stratocaster, which it was an old 63 Strat.
Mm-hmm.
And it had this loud buzz, cause it's got the single coils, and I remember Bo was complaining about the noise, and he goes, "Can't you use another guitar?" And I go, "No, but this one sounds so good." And I had to convince him. I said, "Listen to any Jimi Hendrix record. You can hear his guitar buzz. It's
right.
Like it's part of the whole vibe." And I really had to like talk my way, convince him to let me use that guitar, because he didn't want me to use it because it was just so noisy.
So yeah, it sounds like just maybe different philosophies. You liked a little bit more natural. He wanted more like clean sounding.
Yeah. And then, to top it off though with Bo, my one little bone to pick with him was he brought in that other guitar player, Mike Slamer, to play on Scarlet Fever.
Oh.
And he plays a little bit on Walking Away, way at the end. It's on the fade out. You could hear a little bit of it. But yeah, that song Scarlet Fever, it was a newer song that Donnie had just finished with. So we didn't, we hadn't worked out everything. And I remember, Ronnie and I hadn't discussed who was going to do the solo yet. So when it came time to do the solo, there was nothing worked out. There was, cause normally when we go into the studio, a lot of these songs we've been playing, we would play them out live. So we had a lot of the stuff already worked out. So we kind of just go in and play it.
Sure.
But this one was still new. So I remember thinking, Ronnie and I always try to divide the solos up kind of evenly. And I said, "Well, Ronnie, why don't you go ahead and do this one?" So he goes in there, and he didn't have anything worked out yet either. And he was just having a problem like with ideas that day. Like, some days you just have those days where you're just struggling with something. And
right.
He spent several hours trying to get a solo down, and he was frustrated. So it was right at the end of the day, and he comes out, and I'm sitting in the lounge, and he goes, "You want to see if you want to try it?" He goes, "I'm just not having any luck." So I said, "Sure, I'll try it." So I go in there, and it was right at the end, and we only had like 10 minutes left or something before we were going to call it a night. And I just went in there just to see what would happen. And I ran through it, and it wasn't really, you know, I didn't come up with anything right away, but my way of operating is I would take I asked Bo for a rough mix of the track, and I would take it back to the room and then work on it. And that's what I would do when we record records. I'd always take a rough mix of the basic tracks, and then I'd go back to the room and just work on stuff and refine the solos and all that stuff. So I asked Bo for a copy of Scarlet Fever, and he gives it to me. I go back to the room and I worked out, I got everything together. So I was supposed to be back at the studio at 10 a.m. and I had the solo ready, and this was in the middle of the winter, and we were staying, where were we, on 57th Street or something, or further down. I forget where
it was. It's in New York.
It's
cold, though, yeah.
Yeah, freezing cold. And I had to walk to the studio. And so I had to walk up along Central Park up to 60th in Broadway. And I had my Stratocaster case, and it was windy and freezing, and I remember running, like, because I didn't want to be late, and I remember slipping and falling in the middle of an intersection, and the light changed, and all this wall of taxi cabs was coming at me.
Jeez.
And my first thought was, I grabbed my Strat case and slid it to the curb, because I was trying to save the guitar.
Wow.
But anyway, I get to the studio, and I hear this music. As I get off the elevator, I can hear someone playing guitar, like doing this Van Halen stuff. And uh-oh. Then I realize it's coming from our studio. And I go there, and I go try the door, and the door is locked.
No.
And I'm like locked out. So I'm standing in the hallway, and I'm listening to Scarlet Fever, and there's some guy going, you're playing all this Van Halen over top of it. And I'm going, what? You know, so I go back, and I go back to the lounge, and I just kind of hang out and wait. And I'm waiting for them to get done. And then all of a sudden I hear Walking Away come on. And that was one of my songs, Walking Away. It was one of the ones that I was supposed to play the solo.
Yeah.
And we hadn't even got to it yet. So all of a sudden I hear him playing on that song, and I'm going, wait a minute. Like, Bo didn't even, like, hear what I was going to do. Like, how does, you know.
Oh, man. Are you going to be pissed?
I was. Because it takes a lot for me to get pissed.
Yeah, because you seem like a pretty mellow guy from what I've seen.
Yeah. But when I heard that, like, steam came out my ears.
Yeah, because he didn't tell you ahead of time, right? It's kind of like you got blindsided.
Yeah, right. So I remember, and I'm still locked out, so I couldn't go in there. And I just remember I was so mad that I was like shaking. And I remember walking back, and the rest of the guys were sitting in the lounge. And I just stood in the doorway with this look on my face. I couldn't even talk. I was so upset. And they all looked at me. And I said, all I said was, I got to get out of here. And I just turned around and I left, and I walked around. Like walked for like an hour, and then I came back because I just had to walk it off. And finally, you know, I got to talk to Bo, and I let him know that, you know, I didn't appreciate the whole, like, the Scarlet Fever thing was one thing, even though he didn't let me try my solo that I had worked out.
Mm-hmm.
I never got to do it, but Walking Away, I said, I haven't even attempted that one yet. So
right.
he let me go in and record that one. Mm. And he ended up still sneaking in a couple of Mike Slamer's licks way at the fade out, but at least I got to play the bulk of it.
Crazy. Well, he did give he did give you the cool nickname though, Damage, on that. So that's kind of a cool story how people would misspell your name. Instead of Brian, they put Brain. And so then he'd call you Brain Damage. That's a pretty cool nickname, though.
Right.
Damage. I mean, it could have been better. What if he would have said Brain Fart or something like that? That would have sucked. But
right.
You guys,
but I, used to, I would show up there with a hangover, right, and moaning and groaning, and so that's how that happened.
So, and then,
I just have to say this at the end of that story.
Yeah.
That was my problem with Bo and that record, but Bo is actually a really cool guy, really nice. And other than that, we had a great time. I'm a really funny guy, and we joke around, and I thought he did a great job on the on the record.
Yeah.
So, so those are just like the two sides of it.
Sure, I get that.
And since then, he's come and hung out with us, and he'll show up here and there.
Yeah, and you said, he remixed the Blow My Fuse remaster or whatever, right?
Yeah. So I don't really. I sort of made my peace with that.
That's good.
Even though I still tell the story. But.
Yeah. So I heard a story too that I don't know if it was around this day or maybe the Blow My Fuse days, but. You guys used to have Poison open for you back when they're actually called a different name, Paris. They were a cover band, and the crowd would go nuts. Like, what do you remember about them from back? I know they had a different guitar player, but it was Brett Michaels. Was he a really nice guy? But he seems like a really nice guy now. Was he really nice back then, or what were they like?
Yeah, they were nice. This was early days. We used to do all age shows up around Scranton, Pennsylvania, at this place. It was like a club, but it used to be a theater, so it had a proper stage and all that. And those guys used to open. And it's funny, they had a guy named Matt Smith on guitar, a different guy. And this was before, before they went to California. But, they were just these young guys, and this was back in the spandex.
Yeah. Did they have a lot of makeup on now? Because that look what the Cad Dragged In album. I mean, they full on look like women in that album cover.
Yeah. They went fully glam when they went out to LA.
This
was pre-glam, but they were still, it was still like the, David Lee Roth and like the spandex with the scarves or the bandanas tied around the leg. And,
right. Okay.
And they were still, young, good looking guys. But the thing was, this particular club, the dressing room was off the side of the stage. And once you go in there, like we'd be in the dressing room and they'd start playing, we couldn't leave because the door led to the stage. So we'd have to just sit back there and wait and listen to them. And I remember they weren't that good.
That's what you said. Yeah.
Yeah. And they,
but the girls went nuts, right?
Yeah. So at one point we peeked out the door, and it was all like young girls, and they were just melting in front of Brett. Like they couldn't get enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds about right.
So it was amazing. They just had that appeal, or at least Brett did.
Yeah. The swagger. No, they were a fun band for sure. So, but then you guys go into the next album, the Blow My Fuse. That's the big one, the album. And it actually went gold before even the big hit was Don't Close Your Eyes was released. I heard you say that. But that then out that song's released, and that reaches number 11 on the Billboard Top 40 chart, which is huge. I mean, you've crossed over into the pop now, and then eventually the album goes platinum. I saw also recently that Rolling Stones, they did top 50 hair metal albums of all time. I don't know if you saw this, but that album was named number 8 of the top 50 hair metal albums of all time. So that must have been really, that was like probably the heyday of the band, right? I mean, that was the most success that you guys had had.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, Don't Close Your Eyes was our hit.
Yeah. And
but,
that you did the first,
yeah, that,
the first big tour with Rat. You guys actually had a tour bus and everything, right?
Yeah, because before that we would open here and there, like the Aerosmith thing, or we opened for ZZ Top a couple of times, but they'd only be like one or two shows here and there. So yeah, the Rat tour was our first proper tour, where we actually had the tour bus and all that, and did, it was the whole arena tour.
Yeah. So was there a lot of shenanigans on this tour? Like I had Keith Douglas from Tora Tora, and he was saying, I was asking him about like their tour compared to like Motley Crue. And he said they were like milk and cookies compared to Motley Crue. Like, so on a scale of like Tora Tora to Motley Crue, like where was Kix? Like, I know you said you guys only did stuff after the shows. You wouldn't drink before or during, but I heard that between you and Ronnie, you'd polish off a quart of Jack Daniels a night. There must have been some crazy stuff that happened after a quart of Jack Daniels every night. Like, was there fights or property damage and girls? Like, I mean, if you compare it to the movie Motley Crue, The Dirt, like, was anyone riding a motorcycle down the hallway of the hotel or throwing TVs out the window or anything like that?
No, not quite. I mean, we didn't have the money to cover the damages, so we were a little more careful.
Okay, gotcha.
But you know, there were some things along the way. By the time we got to Rat, though, the beginning of Rat tour, Ronnie was in rehab, and I had stopped drinking, too. So when Ronnie came back from rehab, neither of us were drinking at that point. But earlier, before that, there were some times. There was one, oh, man. There were some funny ones, though. There's one story we played in Cleveland, I think it was. Was it Cleveland? Yeah, and there was a blizzard. And we played anyway. The club was open, but it was snowing like crazy. And so it was a small crowd. But we just showed up and we did our full-on show for this small crowd. And they loved it. And I remember after the show, when they went to load out, they pushed the door open. There was like a 3-foot like snow drift against the door. So we make it back to the hotel, and the opening band was staying there too. So one of the things that we would do, we'd always make sure, like, when the party would happen in the opener's room, not in our room. Hmm. So we could go to their room and cause a ruckus and make a big mess, and then just leave and go back to our nice clean room. Like, we didn't want strangers in our room.
Yeah, so, that's smart.
So anyway, I go down there, and I forget who else was there, but there was a bunch of people, and I would always like start, like, I was always kind of like the quiet guy that would cause trouble in the background that nobody really noticed at first.
Right.
And I remember there was some girl there that knew that was friends with the warm-up band, and I was talking to her or hanging out with her, and for some reason I got this stupid idea to I think I was out in the hall and I saw there was a fire extinguisher or something, and I grabbed it and I brought it in the room and decided to make a I just wanted to goof around, so I lit some toilet paper on fire in the bathroom, and then sprayed it with the fire extinguisher. But it was just like tiny; it wasn't a big deal. But if you've ever sprayed a fire extinguisher,
those things go crazy.
Yeah, they just expand. So I light this little fire, and I just go like a short little spray, and then we came out of the bathroom. I think I left the thing in the bathroom, and I was like, "Uh oh!" So we come out of the bathroom, and I close the door, and we're standing there. And then one of the guys whose rooms it is, he comes over and he goes, "What's going on over here?" And that the CO2 is coming out from under the door, and he goes, "What's going on?" And he opens the door, so I just take off running, and I think the girl followed me out. And I go running down the hall, and the guy comes running out behind me with the fire extinguisher, spraying it down the hall. And
okay. So now it's not just a little bit, then. It's a lot.
Right. So I get to the elevator and jump on and go all the way down to the basement. And by the time I come back out of the basement, I hear the fire alarms are going off because he set off, it set off the spring. It's set off the spring.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
And so I had to like sneak back. I got back up to the floor because my room was on the same floor as their room. When I came off the elevator, it was like, actually I couldn't take the elevator anymore after that. I had to take the steps because since the fire alarms went off, I couldn't get on the elevator. So I get up to the floor that I'm on, and you couldn't even see like 5 feet in front of you. It was just a cloud of that CO2. Wow. But it looked like smoke. And I remember I made my way back down the hallway to my room, And as I'm going, there's people coming out, like opening their doors, and they have kids with them. And I'm like, oh man. And so those guys, the warm-up band got trouble for this. And it was something that I started.
Whoops.
But they couldn't get thrown out because it was in the middle of a blizzard. So they couldn't leave. So they had to let them stay there. But the fire trucks came, and they ended up getting fined for it, I think.
Jeez.
But I felt bad, but I wasn't going to say anything.
Right. Well, crazy things we do when we're young and dumb. But, geez. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I thought this was interesting, too. I heard that you guys, I don't know if it was around this time, but at one point you guys were making 15 to 20 grand a show. But that all went into some bank account, and then you guys had to pay for management, accounting, road crew. And so then you ended up only getting about $500 a week after all these like shows that you're doing, and you have a platinum record and MTV and all this. It's only $500 a week?
Yeah, we had a band account, and we had accountants. Well, that's the thing. We had a manager, we had a booking agent, we had accountants, we had a lawyer, all these people we had to pay commissions. And so, yeah, all our money went into this account, and then we got a weekly check of $500.
Damn.
And that, at our peak, I mean, I never made it over $500 the whole time. That didn't even start till I forget what year, but, yeah, that was the most I ever made.
So how do you, like, pay the – I mean, obviously on the road, they're paying for the hotel, and I'm sure all the meals and the drugs and the drinks and all that stuff's comped. But, like, how do you pay your rent and like, for your mortgage and that kind of stuff? Or did you even have that? Did you just kind of live off the road?
Well, Hagerstown, Maryland is pretty cheap, and this was back in the 80s.
Mm.
But I bought a house.
Hmm.
At one point, but you know, back then it was like a two bedroom, like this little tiny house on a half acre, but it was 73,000, I think. So my mortgage payment was only like $600.
Oh, okay. So I guess that pays the bills. So then eventually, you know, after the height of your success, you guys did another album, Hot Wire, which I think is great. And you thought it was great. And then you ended up leaving the band in 93 because that album didn't do as well as you thought it should. The grunge scene kind of came out in the 90s, which rubbed you the wrong way. And then you moved out to LA. And I remember seeing this in a documentary on MTV. It was you. I was going to ask you about this because I thought it was you, but I wasn't positive. But then I heard you talking about it. You were painting billboards for your brother, and you're still doing bands at night, right? But you were, to pay the bills, you started as a sweeper in his warehouse, right? But then you were painting billboards, right?
Yeah. When I left the band, you know, my plan was to move. Well, I actually put a band together before I even got out there. But my plan, you know, was to move out there and continue playing music. But so I lined a job up with my older brother because he owned a sign company, and that's where I started. And he just like was helping me out, so he hired me. Like $10 an hour or something to just clean up around the shop while him and my other, well, he had a few guys working for him at that point, and they'd be out painting and I'd be in the shop just doing stuff around there. And then right away he started training me how to paint, but it took me a little while to learn how to do lettering and all that stuff. But as soon as I got up and running, you know, he teamed me up with another one of the guys that worked there. And we'd go out and paint these billboards.
How humbling is that to go from hanging out with Steven Perry and Aerosmith and opening for all these crazy bands and having a platinum record and being on MTV to go from that to sweeping floors and painting billboards? I mean, that's got to be humbling, right? Or like, I mean, what was going through your mind mentally at that point?
Yeah, it was a little bit. Well, yeah, because like I said, you know, only making $500 a week, I didn't have savings or anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had about as much money to last me about 2 weeks when I left.
Jeez.
And so I had to work, and I just sort of did it. And it wasn't too bad, except my brother, his company, he had the sign part of the company, and he was partners with this other guy that had the... It was like the construction side of the company that actually hung the boards and did the maintenance on the boards. So the guys that worked over there were these rough and tumble guys that drove the crane trucks and all that. And I remember a couple of times this one guy, oh man, he would come in and he would give me such a hard time because he knew who I was. And he would just make fun of me.
Wow.
You know, like, this is a lot different than, you know, I forget what he would say to me, but I would just ignore him. I you know, I didn't try to let
You're getting
get
bullied. You're getting bullied as an adult. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. So this is kind of a dark time for you because this is kind of when you slipped more into the drugs and stuff and you started smoking crack and doing heroin. So I got to ask you about this, though. I know that you had some offers to, you had an offer to join Andy McCoy's band. You turned that one down, but you were in a band. Did I hear this right? You were in a band with Steven Adler, and somehow, I mean, you must have been on pretty bad drugs because Steven Adler fired you from the band, right? Or his girlfriend did. What was the, which band was this? And you got to tell me the story of how the, how you got kicked out of a band from, like, how did Steven Adler fire anyone at this point in his career?
Yeah, I'll tell that story. Well, actually, the Anna McCoy thing, that never happened because he never actually approached me. But later on, I met the singer for, what was it?
Michael
Shooting
Monroe?
Gallery.
Yeah. Oh, the singer for Shooting Gallery. Okay.
Yeah, and he told me that Andy was talking about, like, they were trying to find a guitar player, and my name came up. But Andy said, he'll never leave Kix, so he didn't even bother to call.
That was when you were still in Kix. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So anyway, this Steven Adler thing, I forget how it came about, but I remember meeting him. We met at a Jerry's Deli out there in Studio City, and to talk about doing some music, and he wanted to put together a band that did like covers.
Oh,
and,
interesting!
And do like a residency at one of those clubs. I think it was Billboard Live maybe at the time. I forget. But so anyway, I met up with him and we're talking and I was starting to get into the drugs at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven was actually clean at the time.
Oh, really?
But,
okay.
But because of his experience, he could tell that I was high.
Sure, you know. He knows what that looks like. Yeah, I think he's experimented a time or two.
Yeah, and I would know, you know, now that I'm experienced, I would know if I saw somebody, just the pinned eyes and all that stuff, you can tell.
Okay.
And so he looks at me, and so he brings that up, and he goes, you know, he asked me about it, and I said, yeah, and he goes, you got any? And I said, yeah. Oh, no, I said, I go, no, you know what? Because I knew he was clean at the time.
Oh.
And he was poking around to see if I had any on me. And I'm like, no. I said, I don't want to be responsible for that. I said, I can't go there. And he ended up talking me into it. He goes, no, I'll take complete responsibility. And anyway, long story short, we took a ride and he ended up doing some of my drugs. And then he just went off the rails. I don't know if you ever saw that. Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Did you see
Celebrity Rehab?
Show?
Yeah.
Well, that's once he starts, he's like overboard. And so that's what happened. And I'm, you know, when we started getting, it took a couple weeks to get full blown, but, you know, we started rehearsing and the next thing I knew, he would be knocking at my window at my apartment, like early in the morning. Cause I guess all his drug connections had been cut off at that point.
Oh,
so he'd come over cause he knew I had some. So he'd be at my place and then he'd go, and I go, what? I try to tell him, no, these are my, I need this stuff. And he would say, well, he goes, I'll buy you more. So it ended up this thing where he would just hand me money and I'd have to go downtown, buy all these drugs. And then, you know, I'd get my share out of it and he'd pay for it. But that's how he kept it going. But it got worse and worse and worse. And he didn't actually fire me. What happened was he got his girlfriend, you know, it was obvious. He can't hide it.
Yeah.
I mean, he got so bad that there was no way he could hide it. So she just like blew up on him he comes home. I guess they did an intervention. I think that's what it was.
Oh.
And he blamed the whole thing on me. Like, he just didn't take any responsibility.
Oh,
like he said he was
fucking. Yeah, right.
So I remember I was, I think I was still working at the time, because this was right near the end, because at some point I couldn't work anymore, but I was still working. So I get home from work, and it's like 2 in the afternoon, and there's a message on, and this is before cell phones, so there's a message on my answering machine, and I hit play, and it's Steven's girlfriend.
Uh-oh.
And she's screaming into the phone, saying, she was calling me every name in the book, but she goes, don't you ever come around our family ever again. We never want to see your face. And she goes, and if you want your, like my amp and stuff was at Steven's rehearsal place. He had like a lockout.
Okay.
And she goes, if you want your equipment, it'll be in the alley outside the rehearsal.
Jeez.
Or she goes, and she told me what time, or she goes, at noon or something. And it was like 2 in the afternoon. And I'm like, oh man.
Shit.
So I jumped in my car and I sped over there. And sure enough, there's my stuff. And it had like a packing blanket over top of it, but it was like Marshall cabinet, my vintage basement head, and it's just sitting out in the alley in North Hollywood. And I'm like, so I had loaded it up in my car and I drove it back, and that was the end of that.
Did that band ever get off the ground? What was that wasn't Adler's Appetite then? That was something different.
Yeah, this is just I don't even know if it had a name, but
okay.
But they ended up. He ended up recruiting Ronnie into the deal at some point, too. Ronnie came out, but I don't think that ever, I don't know what happened. I know they did a couple shows, but it didn't last very long.
Gotcha. Well, then you ended up going to jail. You ended up getting sober, though. And then years later, then you end up reuniting with Kix in 2003. Steve calls you. He hadn't talked to him in 10 years. And you guys decide that you're going to reunite the band, but you're not bringing Donnie in, because it sounds like Donnie and Steve had quite a bit of a blowout, right? Like, it's said that Steve had called Donnie up one time because he was going to use some song that he had written, and Donnie just went off on him about something, and then he was really mad that you guys reunited without him, and so he sent a really nasty email to the producer. Have you had any words with him since then, or what? I mean, you still don't talk to him?
No. Well, you know, about 6 months before Steve reached out to me, I had talked to Donnie, and it was the first time I talked to Donnie in all those years since I left. And he was really cool at that point. And we just talked about old times, and it was a very friendly call. But then, you know, when Steve called me, to get the band back together, you know, one of the stipulations was, you know, Donnie can't be involved. And it turned out that, you know, the other guys felt the same way. It was just that was the thing with Donnie, just like that phone call. I mean, he could be the nicest guy, and to hang out with him when you're not working, he's the nicest guy. But to work with him was a whole different story. It was like Jekyll and Hyde.
Hmm.
And so nobody wanted to deal with that again. And really the real reason when we first got back together, we didn't even realize we were really getting back together. We were just going to do a few shows, like a few handful of reunion shows. That's what we were planning.
Hmm.
And we wanted to make some money and just have some fun. And we knew if we brought Donnie back into the picture, neither of those two things would happen.
It was really that bad work on them, huh?
Yeah, so that's why we didn't do it. And then, you know, we had no idea it was going to take off like it did.
Well, yeah, so the album, it's on the Billboard Top 100 or Top 200. It's at number 48, which is the second highest charting record ever for Kix. It was not only the number one album from the editors and staff of Sleaze Rocks, but also the readers. And I don't know if you know the year that came out, some of the bands that you beat out for best album on that website were Steel Panther, Tesla, Slash, Judas Priest, and AC/DC. Did that shock you to have the number one album on Sleaze Rocks?
Yeah.
Do you think
that stuff still amazes me anytime that stuff, kind of stuff happens.
Do you think,
you know, that's something you never get used to.
Right. Do you think Donnie was pissed that you guys went off and had the success without him? And I mean, because he was an important piece of the band back in the day with the songwriting and such.
He's definitely not happy about it. But I don't know if he really follows our career. I think he kind of tries to forget about it. In fact, I haven't seen him, but a few people that have run into him here and there,
right,
sort of say that he doesn't want to talk about it. Like, he won't talk about Kick.
Crazy. So you guys don't talk to him. Is there other musicians that you do still keep in contact with? Like, are you still friends with Ricky Rocket from Poison? And
I haven't talked to him in person, but he reached out to me at one point when I was still living in LA. He wanted to put together some kind of side band.
Oh.
And he wanted to know if I was interested, if I'd be interested in doing something. But I was so busy, I had Rhino Bucket and Kix at that point.
Oh.
And I just had to say, that sounds like it would be fun, but I really don't have time.
It seems
I wouldn't be able to put any time.
It seems like everybody's in like 10 different bands, like Tracy Guns from LA Guns. He's in so many, I feel like he's in like 10 different bands, and there's so many musicians that have to, is that kind of part of surviving now, is you have to, I mean, you're in Rhino Bucket and Kix. I mean, you kind of have to be in multiple bands now to make ends meet.
Not really. I mean, Rhino Bucket's not together at this time.
Oh, okay.
For me, it was like, more like a different kind of outlet. Like, Kix is one thing, but Rhino Bucket was a whole other thing. No, it wasn't that far from Kix, but it was different enough to just give me something different that wasn't Kix.
Definitely.
And I think a lot of people, they kind of do that multiple thing because it gives them different, because one band, Kix has their Kix thing, and it's like, it's just fun to have a different style of outlet.
Sure.
In fact, I love playing personally. I love like country music.
Really?
And the early 2000s, I was in this band called the Snake Handlers, which was like a rock and country band.
Hmm.
And, that was like a whole another thing too, but I love doing that, like different styles and, it's fun. Being a musician, anytime you're playing something, it's fun.
Yeah, you like variety too, I'm sure. Well, you're in the right place for country, being in Nashville. So I heard a lot of bands make a lot of their money on their merch, and I saw that you guys already have T-shirts and masks for the quarantine stuff. I also heard, is there once a Kix umbrella as well for the song Cold Shower, or was that only for Steve to have? Is that something you guys marketed?
No, we did. We sold them at the merch table for a while. I forget what happened with those.
Interesting. Yeah, somebody's asking about that, one of the fans. And then I had a question, too, about like movies, music in movies. Is that a pretty lucrative thing for you? Because you've had some songs like in Wayne's World, and then I guess I didn't know Thomas Hayden Church put Rhino Bucket music in one of his movies. He's a big fan. You had a couple songs in the Dead Ant movie that's on Showtime right now with Tom Arnold.
Yeah, the Dead Ant thing, that's not actually us playing it, though. That's some other band covering it. But,
right, so you don't get the money from that then, huh?
No, Donnie probably does.
Yeah.
They had to pay for the song licensing. Since they're Donnie's songs, he probably gets money for that. It's weird. It depends on how it's done, because Rhino Bucket, I made more money doing that kind of stuff with Rhino Bucket than I did playing.
Hmm.
But Kix, we make a lot more on merch and playing live.
Sure.
The soundtrack stuff, it's just kind of minimal. But Rhino Bucket did a lot. Like the label we were on, the guy had these connections, and we had, he had us in a bunch of the sports network stuff.
Oh, that's smart then. Yeah, for sure. Well, another guy that from the movie business that you, I didn't know you were friends with Johnny Depp. Apparently he was in some band in Florida and you guys used to like hang out together and stuff.
Yeah. When we were doing Cool Kids down there in Miami, we were down there for several months and we would go out. There was a club called the, what was it called? It was open until 6 a.m. It was like an all-night club. Wow, I can't believe that name just went out of my head. But anyway, his band used to play there all the time. He was in this band called The Kids. And they were like a rockabilly, kind of a rockabilly vibe. In fact, Johnny, he had just joined that band, and the original guy left, this guy named Cause, to go join the Romantics. So Cause went to the Romantics, and then Johnny was the new guitar player. So we would go hang out and watch him play, and we became friends with Johnny and the singer, who now I can't think of his name now, but I ended up friends with Johnny, and like, he even came out and hung out at Criteria Studios while we were recording, and him and I knew this girl. We were friends with this girl, and she would do these wet t-shirt contests in Fort Lauderdale. So I remember one night she invited Johnny and I to come out because she was doing this wet t-shirt contest. So we go out to the club with her, but it turns out Johnny is not, I think he may have been 20. He was underage, and they weren't going to let him in. And somehow she talked her way in, like she got him in there. She talked to the bouncers, but the only way that they would let him in is if he stood by the DJ booth. He couldn't walk around the club, and I had to stand there with him. I had to make sure he didn't go anywhere.
It's so weird to think of Johnny Depp not being able to get in somewhere right now, like, you know, basically now.
I know.
It's almost been weird. So it must have been weird to see him turn into this giant movie star. Did you probably lost touch with him after that, right? Or
yeah, because you know, back in before, you gotta realize before cell phones, it was hard to keep in touch with people.
Right. Yeah.
So after that, it was like, oh, well, another cool story with those guys were, when we got done with the Cool Kids record, what we would do, like, for every record that we ever recorded, we'd always do, like, this show right at the end after we're done recording and they were doing the final mixes. We'd go out and do a show somewhere just to get it out of our system. So at the end of the Cool Kids record, Johnny Depp's band, The Kids, were playing at the Button South down in Miami, and we were talking to them about maybe getting up there and doing some songs on their gear, and they said, yeah, sure, you know, no problem. So we go down there that night, they're playing, and we jumped up there, and we only did like three songs, but Johnny had this, he had a 56 Telecaster, and an old, like, Marshall 50 half stack. And so I got to play Johnny's guitar, and that put the bug in my ear about playing a Tele, because before that I didn't play a Tele. And when I played, I didn't realize that a Telecaster through a Marshall, I didn't realize what that sounded like till that night. And it was like magic. But that was a cool thing.
Oh, for sure.
But anyway, yeah, I did lose track. I lost touch with him, and then I remember seeing him on 21 Jump Street, and I go, that looks like Johnny Depp.
Weird. That
and it was like,
so
oh, that
weird.
Is that is him.
Wow.
And then I ran into him. The next time I actually ran into him was he was doing that John Waters movie, Crybaby.
Yeah.
And I went down to Hammerjack to see Stray Cats, because we were good friends with those guys too.
Oh.
So I went to see Stray Cats, and after they were done, I went backstage, because Hammerjack, you know, we had the run of the place. We could go anywhere we wanted. So I go backstage and into the office, and you know, to wait to go upstairs where the dressing rooms were. So I'm in the office. I walk in the office, and there's Johnny Depp sitting there, and there's Iggy Pop sitting there, and what's the porn star girl?
Jenna Jameson? Or?
No. I can't believe I can't remember that. But anyway, but there's Johnny, and I'm like, I go, hey, you know, I didn't know if he'd remember me, and I go, you remember me? And he goes, yeah, sure. And so we start talking, and I was like, you still have that Telecast? And he still had the Tele. And
wow.
And then the other cool thing was I got to meet Iggy Pop. I'd never met him before.
Yeah, he's a legend.
Oh man, he was so cool. And he goes, and it was right when Don't Close Your Eyes was taken off, and Iggy knew the song. He goes, man, he goes, yeah, you guys song's doing really well right now.
That's awesome. Wow, that's got to be surreal. And then you actually got to do a little acting yourself. You're in a couple movies, and then and now you kind of have like a YouTube cooking show.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I don't know.
You're big into the paleo. It's not even the paleo. What is it called? The carnivore. You just eat. I'm really fascinated by this. You just eat meat. I mean, I've had some vegans on my show, but I've never had someone that only ate meat. Is that how the diet goes? Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got into it. I really, after I went through the whole rehab and getting sober, that's way back then is when I started trying to get healthy again. I started jogging and doing all this stuff. And I tell this story too. The first gig, when I flew back to Baltimore to do the first reunion show with these guys, it was the first time that I actually saw Steve face to face since for 10 years. And Steve was in such good shape. It inspired me. And so I started trying to get in. I mean, I had already been running and riding my bike, but nothing like that. I saw Steve and I was like, oh man, I want to get in shape. Cause Steve looked like a young Iggy Pop at that point, okay. And I just remember asking him, how did you do that? So that's, I started with the physical part of it. And then the more I got into that, I started, learning about the nutrition part of it. And I don't know if you've heard of bulletproof coffee.
Yeah, where you put the butter into your coffee.
Yeah. Well, the guy, Dave Asprey, is the guy that started that company. When that first came out, that opened my eyes to like the whole fat adapted thing and the keto thing.
Right.
And that's what it sort of opened the door. And I started, it took a long time though, because I'm such a carb sweets addict.
Sure.
I love like sweets and cookies and cake and I love all that stuff. And that was the hardest thing to give up, but it was sort of a transition, but I transitioned, I got into keto, got off the sugar and the carbs and all that junk. And then I really got into like the whole science behind like cholesterol and all the myths that go along with that.
Right. So your cholesterol is good because it's about the ratio. You have high cholesterol, but the ratio from your good cholesterol to your bad cholesterol is really, it's a good ratio. So that's what it's really matters. Is that correct?
Well, it's the ratio between the HDL and the triglycerides.
Yeah.
Those are the numbers that count, but it's weird that the doctors only look at LDL and total cholesterol. And if that doesn't match their numbers that they want to see, they'll try to put you on statin drugs, which that's like a death wish when you get stuck on those things.
Yeah.
So anyway,
and you have no calcium in your arteries. You had a CAC scan or something. That's a perfect zero. So everything's good.
Yeah. Because even though I know that with the cholesterol ratio thing, even though, looking at that, it tells you that you're right. I still had the people going, oh man, you're going to have a heart attack and this and that. So I go, okay, let me go get that test done and I'll prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and had the CAC score thing done and it came out a perfect zero.
Perfect.
But even before all that junk, the whole cholesterol and the diet and all that stuff's all intertwined. I started learning about the carnivore thing. I stumbled on that through, McKaylee Peterson, Jordan Peterson's daughter. I don't know if you've heard of them, but she had horrific like autoimmune issues. Like she had, from like early age, like 5 years old, she had like severe arthritis and like these skin problems. And I think the skin problems may have come later. as a result of all the drugs they had her on because of the arthritis. But she had it so bad that in her teens she had to have like joint replacements, like crazy stuff for a young girl.
Yeah.
And somehow she discovered the carnivore diet and everything disappeared. Her arthritis went away. Her skin problems went away. Like, it just fixed everything. And I remember hearing that story and just being fascinated by it and thinking, you know, I've always had like back problems and gut problems and all this stuff. And I thought, well, maybe I'll try that for a month and see if it helps. And that's what, so then I went from keto, which had already, I felt better on keto, but not quite there yet. And then I went, so when I went total carnivore, it just fixed everything that seemed to be wrong.
Wow.
And I feel so much better. Like all those workouts I was doing, like before carnivore, I was, consider a pescatarian.
Fish,
so basically I was basically a vegetarian that ate fish.
Okay.
So other than the fish, I didn't eat any meat. I didn't eat anything. So jumping into the carnivore was a whole, like,
it's a 180.
It was weird, but I did it. And I remember within 2 weeks, I felt so good. And I remember all those workouts that I had been doing, like I had gotten healthy, but until I went carnivore, I mean, that kicked it into overdrive. And all of a sudden I saw results like right away. My body just like came into shape and like all these things happened and my guts weren't bloated anymore. I didn't feel like swollen. And
do you ever have a cheat day or anything, or do you ever give yourself a
early
break?
I would bounce back and forth. I'd do keto for a few weeks and then I'd go back to carnivore for a week. And then, you know, I would just sort of bounce back and forth. So, you know, I go from just strictly meat then back to some vegetables. But the thing was, you know, this is when I still lived out in LA. I was in this relationship and that ended as a result of my carnivore diet. It was only because it freaked her out when I started eating meat. She just like, she goes, I don't know. I thought I knew you, but I don't know you. Like,
jeez.
Like this whole, but I think it was more than just the meat. I think
it must have been
opened her eyes to more underlying problems that we were having. And so anyway, but with that, so that's why I didn't really jump completely head on into the carnivore completely, because it was a little hard to deal with at home, because every time I'd cook bacon, she would just storm out of the house and go, you know, it would cause problems. So,
gotcha.
So I didn't. That didn't happen until I came here to Nashville. I, you know, now I'm by myself. I can do whatever I want.
Oh, that's nice.
Cook whatever I want. So yeah, that's when I.
Your fans.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah. Your fans were wondering if you're going to open up your own restaurant or have your own cookbook at some point for this stuff.
Well, you know, I would love to have like a diner or something someday. I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be fun. But I don't, yeah, people ask me about a cookbook all the time. But the thing is, I love to cook and I have that little cooking video show thing.
Yeah, and your social media, if people follow, I remember following you on Instagram thinking I'm getting updates about kicks and hanging out with musicians and music stuff, and it's almost all food, which I like. I'm like,
right.
I actually enjoy this though. I'm like kind of curious about, because you'll post these, you know, duck eggs and things that I've never seen. You know, it's not as much as common. Some of the stuff is not as common for meat eaters even. So it's cool though. I like
it. Yeah, because I organ meats and all that, and people are freaked out by that. But you know, it's the funny thing is, people will go, you know, I'll post something and like I fried some spleen, like beef spleen, this week, and it's an organ meat, but it tastes great. Like it tastes.
I'll have to try.
It tastes like chicken liver, and I fried it with I use like pork panko to bread it.
I just got some of that stuff.
Yeah. So. And I fry it in bacon grease, so it tastes. It was like a king size chunk of chicken liver. That's what it tasted like. Mm. And it was so good. But people would see it and they just go, oh, there's no way. I would never do that. Oh, I couldn't do that. And it's like, well, have you ever had it? No.
Yeah.
You know, they just see the name of it and they don't want to deal with it. It's like, well, until you try it,
I'll try it.
You know, you can't really, you can't say you hate it if you've never had it.
Awesome.
But that's the thing. It's like, I'm not, I experiment with all this stuff, but I'm not really, I guess I'm a natural cook, but I don't, I've never, you know, I'm not like Jimmy. Jimmy went to school for it. He went to culinary school. And so he's an official like chef. I'm just it's like a hobby for me. And I love doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm good at throwing stuff together, but then again, I'm only cooking for myself. That's
true.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
So
it's cool. Besides the carnivore diet, is there anything else that you're passionate about, like a charity or a nonprofit? I always like to highlight something that the artist is interested in, if you had something for that.
Oh, that's a good question.
I think I told your management. Maybe she didn't tell you. I'll blame her.
No, I think that I remember her mentioning it in an email, but I never think ahead.
But that's all right.
But well, I used to. There was a point after I went through rehab, I wasn't working for my brother anymore. I got a job at a pet clinic, and it was while I was still at the recovery home. They sent us out to get a job. Like that was part of the thing. You had to have a job.
Sure.
And I started working at this pet clinic in West LA, and I worked there for 12 years. And so that particular clinic worked with a lot of different rescue groups.
Okay.
And there's one called Much Love.
Okay.
Animal Rescue.
Much
and they're not one of the, yeah, there was a few larger ones like the Lang Foundation that they worked with, but Much Love was a smaller operation, and they were kind of a struggling rescue thing that I don't even think they had an official like a kennel anywhere. I think they just fostered out they'd rescue animals and just foster them out, and people would take care of them at their homes for them until they'd be adopted. But so that was one of the charities that
that works.
I would always donate to. And
perfect. Yeah, I just like to highlight, I always like to highlight a charity on each episode. Brian, you've had so much success already. Do you have any future plans with Kix? Like, are you guys going to reschedule your tour dates or cancel them? And also, is there going to be a new Kix album, or is there new material in the works?
Well, as far as the shows, they've all been postponed
the
next month or so. Nothing's been canceled yet, which is a miracle.
That's good. Yeah, because like, I was hoping to go to that Whiskey Go-Go show in July. I don't know if that'll happen, but...
Yeah, I don't know. That's the thing. I mean, all these shows, they've been rescheduled, but then, you never know when this is going to be back up and running. And then now I've heard that, concerts are going to be one of the last things they'll probably let go back to normal because of the crowd. So, who knows what's going to happen with that. But as far as the recording, we have talked about doing another record at some point, and everybody's got their own little ideas. We haven't put anything together yet. I've heard a couple. Steve sent me some MP3 files, a bunch of his songs that he's been writing. So everybody's sort of got some ideas, but we just haven't gotten together to put them together. And it's a shame because we have all this time now.
Yeah.
But I'm here in Nashville. It's like I can't jump on a plane.
Can you not send tracks digitally? Because I know, like, what's that guy? Stevie Rochelle from Tuff. He was in that band called Tales of the Porn. And he actually worked with a band in Brazil, had never met them in real life. But they sent tracks, like, digitally. And then they made an album. And it was, like, pretty good.
Well, that's always the possibility. But I don't know. Kix is, we're one of those bands that it just comes off better if we can get into a room together and just play together.
Okay.
When you start doing it like long distance like that, it comes out a little more generic, and it's almost like once you have the song structure, it's hard to change it after that, after the fact. And
right.
I mean, I have done, in fact, this past week, I did two different tracks for two different people.
Hmm.
One band from up in, where are they from? Up on New York or somewhere up there, or maybe even Massachusetts. I forget where they live. But they sent me a track. I did a guitar solo and some other fills. And then a friend of mine from LA, they wanted to put out they're putting out a song about, this whole, pandemic. It's a pandemic album. So they sent me a track to play on. So I do that kind of stuff, but that's easy because they have the song.
Yeah.
And then I just sort of throw it onto my laptop and then I add a guitar track and then send it back.
Yeah, so you guys wouldn't do like a Zoom concert or an acoustic online concert or any of those kinds of things?
Yeah, people have asked that. Well, see, that's another thing. I don't live up there, so it's like, I mean, I guess...
You could do it through Zoom or whatever, that's what I've seen some bands do. But yeah, it is hard if you're not in the same room.
Oh, bands do that in separate places like that?
I think so, yeah. I think I've seen stuff where they do that. You know, if they're all in the same conference, I mean, I don't really know how it works. It's probably not going to sound great, but... I mean, people are really hungry for music.
I've done some of the Zoom meeting things, but it's they're kind of weird.
Yeah.
I guess there might be a way to do it.
Yeah, maybe think about it. You never know. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on my show. Everybody make sure to follow Brian on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I think you're on all three of those, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else?
Mostly Facebook, Instagram, but yeah. Facebook, I have my personal page, Brian Forsythe, but I also have that Brian Damage Forsythe page, which is like the musician one.
And also the Kicks and Rhino Bucket fan pages as well, right?
Yeah. And I have, I do have a personal website, but you know, I never mess with that.
Okay.
I'm mostly on Facebook.
And the YouTube cooking show that you got is kind of cool.
Oh, that. Yeah. I can't forget that.
Yeah.
You know, my channel doesn't even, I don't know if they name channels or whatever, but anyway, yeah, I'm on there. All they have to do is search
your name. Yeah, it'll all come up. Yep. That's how I found you.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on my show. Is there anything else you want to promote before we end this?
Well, regarding the YouTube, Anyone that checks it out, give me a thumbs up and hit the subscribe.
Yeah.
Because the more subscribers I have, the better.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And I think the restaurant or the cookbook or both, I think that should be in your future too. Because it sounds like there's demand for it. People are asking, so.
Well, I would, yeah, the diner thing is definitely something that I would really consider. Like if I could hook up with a partner or something that knows more about the business, I might consider doing that.
Somebody to invest.
Now that would be fun.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks so much, Brian. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
All right. I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Okay.
All right. Bye, Brian.
Bye.
Well, thank you all for listening and making it all the way to the end. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. I learned a lot about Brian and Kicks. So many interesting things. Shout out to Lisa Rose and all the people in the Kicks fan group on Facebook. Kicks has obviously a really great fan base, and I think we all look forward to hearing new music from them soon, as well as seeing them do more shows. Follow Brian on social media, like I mentioned. I'm on everything as well. If you like these interviews, make sure you hit the subscribe button, so that way you'll never miss an episode. I'm currently looking at booking more guests, so if you have suggestions on who you want me to interview, hit me up and let me know. Until next time, have a great day or night. Bye.